This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Before proceeding with the section of Tanakh that we'll be doing, which will be chapter 8, verse 7, I want to look at a little bit of the background of the idea of this king, who he is and what he is and what provisions were made for him, as we're told in the Torah and as it manifests in the Halakha. The Torah tells us the following in Parsha Shoftim. Ki tovoi el ha'oret asher Hashem elokecha noisein loch virashto vishavtovo. When you come to the land which God has given you, that's the land of Israel, and you dwell in that land and you possess it, and you will say, I want to appoint a king over our souls, like the nations around and about me. You may in fact then provide yourself with a king, appoint a king, and then there are certain conditions. He must be Jewish, he mustn't have too many horses and wives, as we discussed last time. He must write a Sefer Torah and read in it. Leman yilmad liyiro es Hashem elokov, so that king will learn to fear God. The fear of God is a skill, it's an art. It's not something natural, it's not something that just happens, that just comes. It's sophisticated. And the king has to make a study of God-fearing, of what it is to fear God and how to practice that God-fearing. Lishmer es kol divrei ha-Torah hazos, to keep all the words of this Torah, ve'sachukim ho'il el ha-asoson, and these statutes to do them. So in addition to everybody being commanded to do the laws of to keep the laws of the Torah, the king is commanded to be extra special careful in keeping the laws of the Torah. Levilti rum levavoy me'echov, so that he never becomes arrogant over his brothers. And the Ramban says the following on that. Nirmaz bekan b'toiro isur hageus. Here we have stated the prohibition in the Torah of arrogance. There are all sorts of prohibitions, things we're not allowed to do in the Torah. And some of them are well known and some of them are less known. We're not allowed to do certain things on Shabbat. We're not allowed to eat on Yom Kippur. We're not allowed to eat certain types of food. Everybody knows that. But equally, we're not permitted to be arrogant. Arrogance is an isur d'oraisa. It's a prohibition of the Torah. One isn't permitted to be arrogant. It's an offense against the Torah. It's as serious as any other offense in the Torah. More serious, sir. And this is the source of it. The king is told, thou shalt not be arrogant. Ki akosuv yimnoes ha-melech megeus, the Ramban says, the Torah, by prohibiting the king from being arrogant, kol shchein ha-acherim she'enin ruyulim akach. Certainly, if a king isn't allowed to be arrogant, nobody's allowed to be arrogant. For if anybody were allowed to be arrogant, that should be the king. Because the king possibly needs a bit of arrogance in order to rule, in order to assert his will, to govern. But even he isn't allowed to. If the Torah instructs somebody who one might have thought is entitled to be a little arrogant, the Torah tells him not to allow his heart to rise above his brothers. Ki hagayvo mido meguno v'nim eses etzel ha'elokim afilu b'melech. For arrogance is a quality that God detests, even in a king. It's a detestable quality. Arrogance. One of the things that God despises most. Ki l'Hashem levadoi hagedulo v'haroimus. Because exaltation belongs only to God. V'loi levadoi hatehilo uvoyis halel ha'odom. And the only true praise is deserved by God. Everybody else is flawed. What's there to be praised about? Sometimes we do an occasional good thing. There's some nice things about us. But there's a whole lot of bad things about us too. There's nothing for us to get arrogant about. The only one who is entitled to pride and arrogance is God himself. To absolute pride and total arrogance. No human being is allowed to do that. And our pride comes from the degree to which we approximate God, to the degree to which we achieve intimacy with God, to the degree to which we have a relationship with God. That's where we draw our pride from, not from being great ourselves, but from being associated with greatness. That's the difference between human pride, genuine human pride, and arrogance. Arrogance is, I am great, and pride is, I am associated with greatness. Who is the greatness? God is the greatness. And arrogance doesn't mean, or the lack of arrogance, humility doesn't mean that a person doesn't know his self-worth. A person does and should know his self-worth. We discussed last week the importance of the reflection that one gets from other people, how one's sense of self-worth is so often determined and affected by other people's opinions of us. We have to have a knowledge and an understanding of our own self-worth. We have to have pride. But the pride has to be, there has to be a proper relationship between our pride and God. That must be the perspective. So if you can imagine a scale, a graph, with different people with different levels of worthiness, and you would have a graph, some up there and some down here, and all different people at different heights. That's one way of looking at it. But if on the graph you included God, then where would the greatest human being be? Down there at the bottom. You would hardly, it would be just about off the scale. And the smallest, most irrelevant human being would also be nearly off the scale. So you wouldn't see much of a difference. You follow what I mean? If you draw a scale that God is part of, then no human being features much. If you take God out of the scale, then you'll have a big difference between human beings. Arrogance is when you take God out of the scale. And you say, look how great I am compared to everybody else. Thank you very much. Put God into the scale, and where do you feature? Gosh, just disappeared from the screen. That's right. That's humility. Humility is to know that when God is in the picture, I disappear from the screen. And that's why there cannot be humility if there is not a belief in God. If you don't believe in God, what is there to be humble about? If you're an anywhere near worthwhile human being, what should you be humble about? If you're on the top 10% of salary earners, if you're on the top 10% of people of educated people, which I guess most of us are if we take the whole world's population, we're not doing too badly. We take the whole world's population, and where are we? In terms of education, in terms of civilization, in terms of knowledge, in terms of all sorts of things. Well, however we wish to measure ourselves, we rate quite near the top. Why shouldn't we be arrogant? The only reason not to be arrogant is because we fall off the scale when you put God onto the scale. And that's why the Torah objects so heavily to arrogance, because arrogance implies the exclusion of God. There is no place for arrogance if God is on the, if God, God features. And we're told here that the king isn't permitted to be arrogant. If the king isn't permitted to be arrogant, says the Ramban, it's quite simple for us to deduce from that that nobody is permitted to be arrogant at all. That's what the Torah tells us about being a king. What are they doing? I don't think you have to worry about more chairs. We're not letting any more people in. We've started, so the chairs can wait, the people can wait. We don't need it at the moment. Thanks. We'll worry about it at tea time. Just leave them. Please leave them. I don't want to be disturbed while we're studying. Thanks. Thank you. Now let's look at some of the laws of the king. Kovod Godol Nohagim B'melech, the Ramban says, the laws of the king, he says you've got to introduce enormous levels of honor if you're going to have a king. You cannot allow a king to operate without a heavy dosage of honor. U'meisimin loy emo v'yiro b'leiv kol odom. And we fill the hearts of every person with awe and fear of him. There has to be authority. There has to be fear. He has to have power. If he doesn't have power, he's not a king. Shenemar, as it says in the Torah, Soim Tosim, you shall place a king upon you. He's got to be over you, implying a Mosoi Olecho, that his fear is over you. How do we achieve that? Now these laws are important. One of the reasons I'm doing this with you is not only to get an idea of the laws of the king, but there is an element of royalty and regality in every human being. While none of us are complete kings, none of us are supreme kings, each of us has the capacity for being a king in certain areas. And Malchus is in fact a midot, a characteristic. In addition to it being a profession and a political position, Malchus is also a character trait. A character trait of royalty, nobility. Now, I was told recently when I was looking for various names and phrases and things to use in some of my corporate public relations material to keep off words like nobility, because Americans don't like that word. Is that true? Somebody's nodding. They just told me, just don't keep that word away from me. Because this is all, again, nobility is this kind of exclusivity, and America is all about anybody can make it. And a lot gets lost in that process. Anybody can make it, but not everybody does make it. And at the end of the day, those who do make it need to be treated differently from those who don't. And that part of the story very often we miss in modern democracies. We are so taken up with this dream of anybody can make it, anybody can be somebody, that what very often happens then is a nobody can be somebody as well. And then we get angry. And why is he in office? And he's just a nobody. And he shouldn't be in office. Well, why not? If anybody can be anybody, then nobody can be anybody too. And we've got to understand what the consequences are of such a philosophy, of such a way of thinking. Not anybody can be anybody. It's true that anybody has the opportunity, but not everybody has the will. Not everybody has the strength of character. Not everybody has the drive and the desire and the upbringing. And nobility and royalty is a part of Torah. So if it's an unpopular concept in America, then I'm apologizing on behalf of the Torah. It's just a part of truth. It's part of what the Torah. There is such a thing as Malchus. Now, originally, there wasn't a king. The Torah makes, and we'll study tonight, what kind of provision this is. The Torah sort of says, if you want a king, then I'll allow you to appoint one. But it's almost as if that wasn't the desired intention. And that wasn't because before there was a king, there was total democracy. The leadership of the nation has always been from the top down. It is not the bottom that leads the Jewish people. It's the top that leads them. It's God through his agents. The wise people of the generation, the learned people of the generation, yes, the noble people of the generation. They lead, and the other people follow. You want to be a nobleman? Fine, become a nobleman. But that means changing your way of living and changing your belief systems and changing your value system. It's open to you. But until you've made that commitment, you don't have the same say as somebody who has made that commitment. And so we'll be understanding something of the desired way of ruling. And one of the ideas is, if you have a king, kovod godol no'agin b'malach, a lot of dignity has to be attached to it. You can't have a king without the dignity. You cannot have a king without the honor. And there's some things I'm learning about the United States, and there's some things I find very difficult and can't understand. And some of them I'll share with you. I'm sure I'll find some of you will be able to explain it to me. I was walking through the streets of Washington one day when the president drove across. It was very impressive. It really was very, very impressive. And I said to myself, this is a nation that understands this principle. Kovod godol nagin b'melech. Come and sit down. There's two seats in the front here, there are two seats on the left there, some seats in the back. A lot of dignity attached to that, a lot of COVID attached to that. It was very, very impressive. And yet, built into the system, which also is there are a lot of admirable things about the fact that anybody can question, the fact that anybody can criticize. There are a lot of wonderful things about that, and that controls a lot of the excesses of power. But on the other hand, it almost seems to me as if we understand this concept of dignity, and we create the structures that provide that dignity, but we're not prepared to show that dignity ourselves. The way, certainly in modern times, the way the media are permitted to destroy leaders, whether they deserve it or not is a different discussion. Don't appoint people that do those kind of things. But if you do appoint them to that position and you want them to be a melech, then you've got to create the structure in which they can govern. And you cannot govern if there isn't authority. You cannot govern if there isn't awe, if there isn't respect, almost fear. And what we're seeing is an attempt almost to provide a structure of dignity without a value system of dignity. And I'm not getting into the questions of the character of a leader. We'll look at that in a moment. What kind of person does he need to be? But whatever kind of person he is, once you've got him in that place, there's got to be unquestioned dignity. Because if you remove the dignity, you've removed the malchus. He cannot govern. There's no point in it. You've destroyed him. Now, of course, here, I suppose, because destroying a president is part of the game, that starts laying the grounds for the next round. So it's all, there's an aspect of it which is very serious, and there's an aspect of it which is a game. There's an aspect of it which is a sport, and there's an aspect of it which is life and death. And when I said there are things that I'm finding difficult to understand, I'm finding it difficult to understand how America brings those things together. This is either a game, an entertainment, and media material, or this is international statesmanship. But you can't mess around with international statesmanship, and you can't pretend that a game is international statesmanship. One has to take a decision as to how serious one wants to regard one's leadership. And what kind of COVID, for example? There are structural things. Ein Rochvin al Susu. Nobody else rides in his Cadillac or whatever car he drives. Ein Yoshvin al Kiso. Nobody sits in his seat. Again, I mentioned to you, this is not only talking about leadership today or then, but in each one of us. We talked in one of the early shiurim, I think it was the second or the third shiur, about the need to... There's still some seats in the back, a couple in the front. We talked about the need, for example, in a home, to have a degree of respect, a degree of dignity. That a parent isn't the child's best friend. The child has his friends. But in addition to that, there needs to be, if a parent requires authority, he needs to be able to assert a certain amount of dignity. What are the measures of dignity? Silly little things they look like. They seem to be aesthetic. They seem to be almost window dressing things, but they're important. And Yoshvin al Kisoy, nobody sits in his place. Ein Mishtamshim b'Sharvitoy, people don't use his scepter. Loi b'Chitroy, people don't use his crown. Loi b'Echod mikol klei tashmisho, nor any of his utensils, nothing that the king uses, may anybody else use. One has to build an aura around something that is special. It's not just it's special and the aura becomes natural. You actually have to construct the aura. If you don't construct an aura, you can destroy something even if it's very special. We gave the example a week or two ago. Take any great work of art, take the Mona Lisa in the Louvre in Paris. Would you notice it if it was hanging in the restroom? Would anybody stop and look at it? Nobody would. It would be insignificant. It would be unimportant. It's the aura that is created around it that draws attention to it, that creates a distance, that makes a person say, oh my goodness, Leonardo da Vinci, the Mona Lisa, let me have another look at this. And we look at it seriously, and as you look at it, you begin to see things. But if the aura wasn't there, you wouldn't see anything. If you take a human being, any human being, and you dress him up for the part, and you create the aura around him, the chances are you'll start noticing some pretty interesting things about him. And pretty good things about him, too. if we bring everybody down to the lowest common denominator, we notice nothing about one another. We need to make an effort sometimes to create the environment in which we can magnify things that need to be magnified. And aura is one of the things that do it. So we have to create an aura around this king. One may not see him when he's naked. When he's cutting his hair. Not when he's taking a bath. Now, it's already said we can't see him when he's naked. So what does it mean when he can't see him when he's taking a bath? I guess that means when he goes for a swim, even if he's got his swimming costume. That's not when you see a king. So you can say to yourself, but really, who cares? Everybody knows he's a human being. Everybody knows that he goes to the bathroom. Everybody knows that he goes to the swimming pool. What's the difference if I see him there or not? It ruins it. It destroys it. And therefore, when the press keep on taking photographs of people in their privacy, it ruins their dignity. And the same applies to ourselves. We assume that it doesn't make any difference how we're seen. I've spoken several times in the Shia already on the importance of developing and preserving a degree of dignity. I'm not talking about false dignity, I'm talking about genuine dignity. That the way we present ourselves becomes very important in the way we are perceived by others. And the way we are perceived by others creates the dignity which in turn feeds our self-esteem. It's a whole vicious circle. If we portray ourselves without dignity, we are seen without dignity. If we are seen without dignity, we are treated without dignity. If we are treated without dignity, we feel we have no dignity. And where did it all start? With ourselves very often, for presenting ourselves that way. I'm not suggesting that one must go back to the days of Victorian formality, but there's no question we've gone terribly far in presenting ourselves in the most undignified ways imaginable. In the name of comfort. I want to be comfortable, so I want to dress the way I'm dressed. Does it look good? Who cares what it looks like? I feel comfortable. That's okay. Feel comfortable. But if it doesn't portray anything of human dignity, how can you expect to be getting feedback of human dignity? So you say, well, do they respect me only because of my clothes? No. But don't forget about the Mona Lisa. If it didn't have a beautiful, golden worked frame and the correct lighting, and a red carpet and a chain around it, nobody would look at it twice. Does that mean you're admiring the red carpet? No, you're admiring the Mona Lisa. Does it mean you're admiring the frame? No, you're admiring the Mona Lisa. Does it mean you're admiring the interior decorators? No, you're admiring Leonardo da Vinci, but you wouldn't notice it if it wasn't for that. We don't relate to that. We don't understand that. That as precious as our qualities might be, unless we frame them, unless we present them in a dignified way to our children, to our friends, to our associates in business, unless we do that, it can't be related. And if you've got a king, we've got to frame him. We've got to put him in the right context. And that means he is distanced from society somewhat. Yes, he does need to be distanced if we want to have that kind of aura. And so the laws go on. He should take it. How often does he go to the barber shop? Every day, says the Rambam. He must be very well groomed. U'masakin atzmo, he must groom himself in every way. U'misna'e b'malbushim noyim u'mefuorim, and he should wear beautiful and glorious clothes. Ve'yoshev al kisei malchuso, and he sits on his throne, b'faltrin shaloi, in his palace. Again, there's something of this that we each need to learn. We don't have to have thrones, and we don't have to have palaces. We don't have to have golden robes, and crowns, and scepters, but there is an understanding of the relative importance of all this in the positioning of ourselves in some form of dignity, if that's what we want to create. The Rambam goes on to say, "Kederech shechilek loy hakosuv hakovod hagodol," just as the Torah accords him great honor. The chayav hakol bichvodei, and everybody has to treat him with honor. Kach tzivohu liyus liboy bekirbo shofer. So also the Torah commands him to be humble. Remember, we spoke a week or two ago about the difficulty of believing in God when belief is contradictory to our own efforts. You go to work, you invest effort and money, you see results, and you're supposed to say, it comes from God. not from me. So all the time we're working and you've got to give God the credit. It goes against the grain sometimes. Here we've got another mitzvah that goes against the grain. The king is honored enormously. And he drives around and he's beautiful. Motorcade, and he lives in his beautiful palace and he sits on his beautiful throne and he wears these beautiful clothes. And at the same time there's a mitzvah that applies to him all the time to be humble and modest. He must never be unnecessarily arrogant. And he should be sympathetic and empathetic to people, to ordinary people and big people, whoever. But it's a tough thing that we're asking of him. And it requires in us the need to provide him with a framework of honor and dignity, and for him to provide us with a noble character worthy of the dignity we give him. And that's the relationship. And yes, it's a major, I'm concerned that with all that's going on at the moment, some of the main points are really being missed. They're focusing on such minute detail. The issue really is, to what extent is the moral character of an individual relevant to his job as a leader? And what people had better watch out for is, if you say that it is relevant, and that a leader is expected to be a man of high moral caliber, which is certainly in accordance with the way that we view things, that that applies just in the same in business leadership. That's not only to a president. There are lots of leaders. So he's a president of a large nation. And then you get governors of states, mayors of cities, and chief executives of business organizations, and heads of families. It goes all the way down. If leadership requires nobility of character, then anybody who is in a position of leadership requires to have nobility of character. That's one of his qualifications. Not something exclusive to one man that you elect for the highest office in the land. Not at all. But that's the real debate. To what extent should we be looking at moral fiber and moral character as one of the requirements of leadership? What extent is one of the requirements? To what extent should that be taught in business schools? To what extent should that be a requirement of public office? To what extent should that be a requirement of a person sitting on the board of directors of a public company? Those are the real issues that have to be looked at with all of this that's going on. Otherwise, we're going to get the same thing coming on over and over again until it's resolved. And what we're seeing in the Torah is, it's got to work both ways. Treat him with enormous dignity, and he is obligated to respond with humility and with nobility of character. Now let's get to our Shmuel. The people have asked for a king. Shmuel is very disturbed with this. Turns to God and says, look what they're doing, they're just rejecting me. And God says, don't worry, they're rejecting me, they're rejecting God, he says. It's not just the people, it's not just Shmuel that's being rejected, it's God himself is being rejected. And God says to Shmuel, in verse 7, Vayomer Hashem el Shmuel, and Hashem says to Shmuel, Shema b'kol ha'am, listen to the voice of the people, l'chol asher yomru elecho, to whatever they tell you, ki lo yischol mo'osu ki osi mo'asu min loich aleim, it is not as you they have rejected and despised, it is me they have despised from ruling over them. And I explained to you last week the different types of relationship that there can be with God, and that they were opting for a shift. That God can relate to us in a very highly, finely tuned way, or in a less finely tuned way. He can relate to us in a way where every good thing we do gets an immediate positive response, and every bad thing we do gets an immediate negative response, or it can be lessly fine-tuned, where he leaves us more latitude to do our own thing before he intervenes. And they've chosen, says God, to go the natural way, to go normal causality, normal physical causality, rather than moral causality. It's interesting that in Israel, always, even till today, there is more of an understanding of moral causality. And you see it happening, particularly when Israel gets into crisis. I remember just before the Six-Day War, the Ponovizhirov met with Moshe Dayan. And he said to him, you know, we have tens of thousands of boys in yeshiva. If you need them, they're at your disposal. Tell us what you want them to do. And he said, I fear I might need them. I might need them to dig graves. What they should do meanwhile is say Tehillim. That's from a completely secular, agnostic sort of person. You don't hear that often. When an army general says, I need these people. What do I need them? The army general. I need them to say to him. That's going to have impact on the outcome of the war. And once again now, I got an email from my sister telling me how people are talking about with the Iraqi crisis and so on. People are saying, let's do tshuva. What can we do to improve things? What can we do to make this a better place, but God won't want to destroy it? It's an interesting response. Not in all circles, obviously, but that it exists in any circles is amazing. That a nation is threatened and the response is, what can we do to make ourselves a more moral nation? Not what do we do about our army. Of course they're worrying about that as well. The professionals are worried about that. But the man in the street in certain areas is saying, what can we do to make our society a more worthy society, worthy of preservation, worthy of protection? But outside of that, in the rest of the world, we think very secularly, and every threat we encounter, we tend to respond within a physical way. What can we do to protect ourselves? When they talk about El Nino coming, they fill sandbags. Well, it's a logical thing to do. It's natural cause and effect. How do we protect ourselves from that? Yeah, fill the sand mounds. Protect. There's no sense at all. You'll never hear it said, El Nino coming. What can we do to a bit of tshuva? Let's make this a place that's worthy, that God should take care of it. We don't think that way. And the children of Israel at this point were opting for that more natural way of operation. We don't want to be governed and driven by constantly having to say, what should we do to improve ourselves? We want to be like the other nations. And therefore God says, they've rejected me. And therefore do what they want, but warn them what this king will be. And here comes Shmuel's speech to them in verse 10. Vayomer Shmuel is called Divrei Hashem, and Shmuel told all the words of Hashem El Ha'om to the people, Asholim Meitu Melech, who requested a king from him. Vayomer, and he said, Zeyiyeh Mishpat HaMelech, this will be the law of the king, Asheyim Loich Aleichem, who will rule over you. Es Beneichem Yikoch, he will take your children, Vesom Loi B'merkavtoi V'Foroshov, and he will put them into his motorcades and into his armies. Barotzu Lifnei Merkavto, they will have to run in front of his chariots. Velosum loy sore alofim, and he'll take your children and make them, put them into the army as captains of the thousands, the sore chamishim, captains of the fifties, the lacharosh charishoy, to plow his fields, the liktzur ktsire, and to harvest his harvest, the laisos klei milchamtoy, uchlei richboy, and to manufacture his items of warfare. Ves benoisechim yikoch, he will take your daughters, le rakochos, le tabochos, le oifos, to work with spices, to work in his kitchens, to bake in his kitchens. Ves sadoisechem, ves karmechem, ves zeisechem atoivim yikach. He will take your fields, your vineyards, your olive trees, and he will give them to his servants. Ves zareichem, ves karmechem, yaso. He'll take a tithe of everything you plant. But not from the sariso v'la'avodim, he'll give it to his civil service. Ves, in other words, the structure is going to get bigger, the tax system is going to get more complicated. The taxation will increase year by year. The bureaucracy will increase. He will need more people to feed that bureaucracy. You're starting a nightmare. Do you realize what you're doing by moving away from the personalized leadership style to an institutionalized leadership style? You're creating institutions that will need to be funded not only by money but also by people. You're taking people out of private enterprise. You're taking people out of your businesses. You're taking people out of profit generation. And you're putting them into government service. It's a disaster. He'll take the best of you. Your donkeys, they'll all work for him. He'll tithe your flocks. And in the end, you will be his servants. Don't think you're appointing a king to work for you. You will work for him. Don't think the government is the servant of the people. The people will become servants of the government. You will slave, you will toil for the government. Half of your income will go to the government. Is that what you want? Uzaktim b'yom ahu, and on that day you'll cry out v'lifnei malkechem, from before your king, asher bechartem lochem, who you've chosen. V'lo ya'aneh Hashem eschem b'yom ahu. And that God won't listen to. If you want to shout out that Saddam Hussein is threatening you, say to him, God might listen. But if you want to shout out that your own government is threatening you, forget it. You put them there. You chose them. You put them there. You live with it. God won't answer that. What a frightening statement. Enemies from outside your borders, God will help you with, but not the enemies you create. And you've created an enemy, or you are about to create an enemy, by opening up this massive bureaucracy and starting an institutionalized system of government instead of a human system of government. One would think they would say, goodness, have you never thought of it that way? You're right. Well, let's just carry on the way we were. Let's find another way out of this. And the people refused to listen to the voice of Shmuel. And they said, no, we insist that there is a king. And we will be like the other nations, and our king will judge us. Notice a difference in the way they talk, however. You notice when they talk the first time, if you go back, very top of the page, in verse 5, they say, at the very top line, Ato simo lonu melech leshofteinu kechol hagoyim. Give us a king to judge us like the other nations. And we discussed that last week. And they said they want to be judged like the other nations, not judged like Israel, not judged by God, not judged by the Torah standards. They want to be judged the same way as everybody else is judged. They say it a little differently now. If you look back at our verse, in 20, V'hayinu gam anachnu kechol hagoyim, that we shall be like the other nations, pause, Ushefotonu malkeinu, and our king will judge us, not judge us like the other nations. We accept that the system of justice will be a Torah system of justice. We want the king to abide by the Torah. And he will go before us and fight our wars. So Shmuel has tried to warn them about what this king will be. Now the picture he painted of the king is very different to the picture I painted of the king to start with. He paints a despotic picture of an abusive king. And when we looked at the laws and the Rambam and in the Torah itself as to what kind of king we're supposed to have, it was quite a different sort of picture. So what is it? Is the king allowed to do all this? Is the king encouraged to do all this? There's a very interesting little sipur hidden away on the parasha of the king where he says the following. The Sipurim learns that when the terrorist says, I want a king like the other nations, what is it predicting that the people will ask for? The difference between the system up until then and the king was that the throne automatically went to the children. So there was a longer term office, they stayed in power a longer time, and then it went to the children. It was that kind of royalty. Whereas previously it was a shofet, whoever was the greatest person at that time. Remember we had Eli. Eli was not Shmuel's father. Shmuel succeeded Eli. Shmuel's own sons are not going to succeed him. Somebody else would have done that if a king wasn't appointed at that particular time. Whereas in the case of the king, it stays inside the family. And the Sipurnu says, V'hoyo harashus b'minui hamelech, k'moshu hoyo harashus b'yefas Torah. An amazing thing. Sometimes the Torah allows things that it doesn't encourage. For example, there is that piece in Kitete where a man goes out to war, a soldier goes out to war, and he sees a beautiful girl on the other side among the enemy, and they capture the enemies, and he wants to marry her. And the Torah tells how you go about it, what you do, take her into his home for many days, and shave her hair, etc., 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 the whole process. Does that mean the Torah is recommending that that's what soldiers do? Not at all. The Gemara says, Dibro Torah, the Torah knows that men in warfare, these kind of things happen, and the Torah creates a vehicle to legitimize it. How to do it in the most appropriate way. But the Torah warns us of the sequence of events. The sequence is, the next piece of Torah deals with the fact that a man might have two wives and not love his first one, and therefore favor his second one. And then there might be children from the first one, and then comes the whole section of Ben Sor and Amore, the rebellious son. And Chazal tell us that seemed to be the consequence. It's true you're permitted to marry this woman in warfare, but the outcome is likely to be a rebellious son, an inability to educate your children, a breakdown in the family values in the process, an inability to transmit the values from one generation to another. In the same way, says the Sipurna, the Torah is telling us here, you may appoint a king. But what Shmuel is warning us here is the consequences could be too terrible. The Torah is allowing it. It knows there will come a time where you will see an inevitability, a need to institutionalize government. But we need to understand the consequences of doing that. And that's an interesting concept, that sometimes life evolves and history evolves to a point where we have to do certain things that are not ideal. But what is important is that in that state of non-idealism, we understand what the consequences are likely to be, and we manage those consequences. We can't eliminate them. We can't avoid them. If a man marries a Yefas Torah, if a man goes into warfare and he marries this person, he may do so, but it's important that he knows what the consequences are likely to be, and he can't eliminate those consequences. He can only manage them. And so the Jewish people are warned, you may go for a king. I will try and dissuade you, says Shmuel. But most important of all, you need to know that it is inevitable, this building of the bureaucracy and this massive taxation and taking the talented people out of the private sector and putting them into government where they'll be unproductive for the rest of their days. All of that is inevitable. It will happen. You can't stop it. If you're opting the king route, you're opting the government route. And this will be the consequence. All you can do is to try and manage for it. And that's what Shmuel's warning them. They hear the warning and they say, no, but we want to stick with this. We do want a king. Absolute clarity, but that's what they want. And Shmuel finally, with some degree of sadness and reluctance, says in verse 21, Vayishma Shmuel eskol divrei ha'om. And Shmuel listened carefully to all the words of the people. Vayedabrein b'oznei Hashem. He communicated them to God. Vayemer Hashem el Shmuel. And God said to Shmuel, Shema b'kulam. Listen to them. V'himlachto lohem melech. And appoint for them a king. It's interesting that when the Torah says, Tanakh says, Shema b'kulam, listen to their voice. It means not only listen to the words they're saying, but listen to what's between the lines. Listen to the way they're speaking. Listen to the sound. Sense the mood. And you'll realize you need to give them a king. V'himlachta lohem melech, but you will put a king over them, not them appoint a king. This is not going to be a democratic process. They're not voting. You will appoint the king. This is still going to be leadership from the top, not leadership from the bottom. You cannot have that kind of authority if the person is appointed from the bottom. It's got to be godly appointed. V'yomer Shmuel el anshei Yisrael, and Shmuel said to the people of Israel, L'chu ish le'iroi, each man, go to your own city, go home, I've heard, there's nothing more to discuss, you put your case, I'll consider it, and I'll come back to you. That ends really the first section of the book of Shmuel, so I'm not going to start the next chapter tonight. We'll have a few minutes for questions before we break for tea. Next week, which is the last shiur before we break, is that right? We'll do chapter 9. I'm going to try and do the whole of chapter 9, which introduces us to the first king, to Shaul, what kind of a person he was, why he was chosen, what his background is, some kind of setting the scene for the appointment of Israel's first king, so that when we resume the shiur in 2 or 3 weeks later, we'll be able to get right into the coronation of Shmuel, of Shaul, and the opening years of Shaul's reign. But that we'll be doing once we reconvene. Meanwhile, since we're still a little bit earlier than usual, let me spend 5 minutes or so dealing with any questions that any of you have on what we've done either tonight or at any time up till now in the series. Anybody want to ask anything? Yes. He could be tried and judged. He couldn't be removed very easily. He was removed by death, and that was part of the responsibility of appointing him and to appoint the right person. But if he did something that was wrong, he could be tried before the Sanhedrin if there were people big enough to try him. But there was a lot of dignity to those trials. It wasn't something that was treated cheaply by any means, and with a great deal of reluctance did they ever do that.